Good afternoon and welcome to the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee of the Minnesota House of Representatives for this Tuesday, February 2nd. My name is Frank Hornstein. I'm the chair of the committee. I'd like to start off by asking members to state present after their name is called. Mr. Dan Dodge, our committee legislative assistant, will take the roll.
Chair Hornstein?
Present.
Vice Chair Cagle?
Present.
Representative Petersburg?
Present.
Representative Barr?
Present.
Representative Bernardi?
Present.
Representative Elkins? Representative Elkins? Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hausman?
Present.
Representative Heinrich?
Present.
Representative Kosnick?
Present.
Representative Mason?
Present.
Representative Murphy?
Present.
Representative Nelson?
Present.
Representative Olson?
Present.
Representative Richardson?
Present.
Representative Torkelson?
Present.
Representative West? Representative West? There is a quorum.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dodge. Our next item of business is approving the minutes for January 28th. Representative Petersburg, do you have a motion to approve the minutes?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the approval of the minutes of January 28th committee hearing.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg, and this will be a voice vote. All those in favor of the motion to approve the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you so much, Representative Petersburg. I know that we have Representative Elkins has joined us. I don't know if anyone else needs to be acknowledged, Mr. Dodge, but I know we have a quorum and we will proceed. Members, this is a hearing I've been looking forward to. I had the opportunity to hear a presentation from Mr. Baker and Mr. Anderson at a conference on transit equity in the latter part of last year. And I think it's very important. This is the beginning, the first week of Black History Month. And there's a very, very critical intersection between transportation, civil rights, equity issues. And that's what we're gonna be focusing on this week. And it's very, very important that we start off with some history. And we start off with a conversation about Rondo and I-94, which I think in many ways is very illustrative of the many issues that we have to address now in 2021 as we tackle the issue of transportation and equity. And so we must start with history. We must start with the implications of that history. And I think we'll end, I believe, on a hopeful note with a way to redress that history with at least one proposal for addressing some of the historical problems and consequences of I-94 and how it was planned and how it ended up happening. I'll just, before I introduce our speakers, I was struck by a quote I saw last night on one of the television station news reports. Jonathan Palmer, who's the executive director of the Hallie Q. Brown Center in St. Paul, which is very close to I-94, said that I wanted just to remind the viewers of that newscast that when you're driving down I-94, you might be driving past and through someone who lived there at one time, maybe literally driving through their living room, uninvited. And I thought that was a very powerful statement. And so I'm, again, very pleased to introduce our first speaker, Mr. Marvin Anderson, who I think in many ways is has been referred to me at least, as the mayor of Rondo. If a neighborhood could have a mayor, it would be Marvin Anderson. He has lived this history. and is deeply connected to the community. And Mr. Anderson, we're so happy to have you here at our committee. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
My name is Marvin. Thank you so much, Representative Hornstein and members of the committee, and thank you all for having us here this afternoon. My name is Marvin Anderson, and I am chair of the board of directors of Reconnect Rondo. Reconnect Rondo is a nonprofit that has been formed to determine the feasibility of building a land bridge over I-94 in the Rondo corridor. From its start about 70 years ago, early 1900s, and for 70 years, the men and women of a small but cohesive community, African-American community, came together in Rondo to form a unique, vibrant, cohesive community. And once they settled in Rondo, these men and women worked long and hard as waiters, Pullman porters, cooks in the railroad industry, laborers in the meat processing industry. They worked as maids, clerks, barbers, and beauticians in the service industry. They ran the elevators and cleaned the streets and did other menial jobs. They married, owned homes, raised families, sent their children to schools and colleges. They built churches, established businesses, formed social clubs and other institutions, and all contributed to the fight against the persistent racism that they would encounter throughout their jobs and throughout St. Paul. Despite the social, political, and the economic odds stacked against them, the community that became known as Rondo survived and thrived until the late 1960s, early 1970s, until it suffered destruction brought on by the twin demons of urban renewal and the construction of I-94. These two demons destroyed the social, cultural, business artery of Rondo Avenue and displaced thousands of residents into a hostile environment. As a result, Rondo at that time was a vibrant culture, but it lost 700 homes, about 300 businesses. After the freeway came through I-94, home ownership declined by 48%. There was a 61% population decline. The intergenerational wealth was $35 million. The education could have created, that gap could have paid for 4,800 college degrees. And when you add up the home equity alone, a wealth gap of $157 million was created through the destruction of Rondo. And it was brought on by the interstate highway system that took part. My story of Rondo begins when I saw my father cry for the first and only time. He got the news that the final appeal of the Twin City Negro Development Company had been denied by the Commissioner of Highways in St. Paul. In 1947, my father and my godfather and three other men were the first successful African-Americans to get an FHA-approved loan in the amount of $97,200. In today's valuation, that would have been close to $1 million that five men without a college education, working as waiters and chef on the railroad, were able to impress Midwest Federal and Savings and Loan and get an FHA-backed loan to build 12 apartment homes in the city of St. Paul. They appealed because the assessor for the apartments, when they were condemned for I-94, said that these apartments were inferiorly constructed. And because of their inferior construction, the award amount for condemnation would be only a fraction of what they had placed on the value that they had placed on the property. Their valuation was $145,000 for these 12 homes. The assessor started at $90,000 for the homes. So my father, they appealed. You first appealed to the assessor supervisor, to the department head, and finally you go to the head of the department. At each step, they were denied. They figured that they ran out of money. They came home, and their dream of providing affordable housing for the residents of Rondo, they watched it perish and died. And my father was never the same again. After the sale, you would have thought that the story could have ended right there, and there would have been sadness throughout my home and the home of my godfather and the homes of the other three partners who lost in this sale. But it only got worse. After the apartments were sold in 1958, they stood vacant for 10 years. And I learned later on that 10-year period coincided with the passage of the statute of limitations. After 10 years, an aggrieved party can no longer sue for an action that might have occurred prior to the running of the statute of limitations. At the conclusion of this period, the state of Minnesota discovered that these units could be divided into blocks of 2, 3, or 4 units, and that they could sell these blocks to developers who could put these divided apartment homes on flatbeds and transport them throughout the city of St. Paul to as far as 8 miles away. So much for inferior construction, as appraised by the city of St. Paul, by the highway department. These homes were built in 1948, and there they are standing to this day, 73 years later. And that's my story of Rondo, but talking to other people, they all have similar recollections of Rondo. People talk about how Rondo negatively affected them. It affected their financial insecurity, their home ownership, their food security, their educational security, their environmental health, their energy security. All were affected by what happened when I-94 went through our community. What happened to the people? Those were the physical aspects of what happened to Rondo. The mental aspects were just as bad as defined by Dr. Mindy Fullilove. She's an urban psychiatrist. She's estimated that there were 1,600 African-American communities that had a similar impact when the freeway or urban renewal came through their locations. And what she has found is that the mental feeling is called rut shock, R-O-O-T-S-H-O-C-K. And rut shock is described as a complete deterioration of a personal ecosystem, and it happens when the world around them is shattered. That once this world is shattered, the individual or the community in which it happened has a rut shock, which involves the dispersal of people to all directions in the compass. It talks about the mistrust, it increases anxiety, it destabilizes relationships, it destroys social, cultural, and financial resources. And it increases the risk of stress and anxiety and heart attacks. But more importantly, it makes people cranky. That's what she described as rut shock. And I have to admit, I was cranky, along with so many other people in Rondo who were just downright cranky at the state for what they did when they destroyed our community of Rondo. And for 37 years, I was Frankie. I got involved in a group called Rondo Avenue, Inc. And over the last 36 years, we have sponsored a festival each year where we celebrate Rondo, the goodness of Rondo, the exuberance of Rondo, in a multicultural festival that has been here for 36 years. And then in 2015, we decided, those who were involved in the Rondo community, that it was time for us to set aside our heartache, time for us to set aside our disappointment, time for us to set aside our resentment and have a Rondo healing and reconciliation ceremony where we actually had our elders, three elders, over 100 years old, take a piece of paper that was symbolic of this pain and burn them in an urn, and then we buried them in the ground, which is now the Rondo Commemorative Plaza. But something else happened that day. Chris Coleman came, the former mayor of the city of St. Paul, and acknowledged the sins of our past. We regret the stain of racism that allowed so callous a decision as the one that led families being dragged from their homes. And on the state side, former Commissioner of Transportation Charlie Zelli said, "An era when the Minnesota Highway Department built an interstate through the heart of the Rondo community, we could never build that kind of atrocity again." And that was the beginning of what we like to call the creation of a new Rondo, a revitalized Rondo, a new renaissance of Rondo, and how we might be able to take advantage of this new awareness, this new cooperation, and build a Rondo that would be reflective of our past and would also speak to how we can prepare this area for the future. And as a result of that, we created an organization called Reconnect Rondo in 2016 to undertake studies and research and to recommend to the community of Rondo how we might harness and unite the history of Rondo, the Department of Transportation, and build a better Rondo. And the result has been the creation of the Rondo Land Bridge that will build a bridge that shows us a better way of how we can live together. And it is my pleasure to introduce Keith Baker, who is the executive director of Reconnect Rondo, to describe for you the work that they have been undertaking with this charge and the result where we are so far. So I thank you for your attention, and I'm turning it over now to Mr. Baker to continue this presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson, very much, and welcome, Mr. Baker. Please state your name for the record.
Keith Baker, Managing Director of Reconnect Rondo.
You can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. Thank you, Mr. Anderson, and thank you, committee members. We appreciate the opportunity to share our vision with the House Transportation Committee. Mr. Anderson and I are here because, you know, we see an opportunity to build a bridge to better, to make Minnesota shine brighter. As Mr. Anderson had mentioned, I am the managing director of Reconnect Rondo. I've spent 35 years working for public, private, nonprofit sectors, and you'll understand a little bit of why that is important to what I'm presenting here today. But I've spent specifically 18 years with the Department of Transportation. And I manage the consultant contracting unit for the metropolitan area, which is 50% of the state's professional technical contracting activity. I also was the deputy director of the Civil Rights Office, as it's named today, but at the time it was the EEO contract contract management office, responsible for overseeing federal rules around contracting as well. I served on the Blue Ribbon Commission that kind of brought rise and attention to racial disparities. So I'm grounded in a lot of ways and really embrace this opportunity to present. The aim of Reconnect Rondo is to lead a restorative movement, to reverse racial disparities, to, you know, by reigniting an African-American cultural enterprise district in St. Paul that's connected to a community land bridge. Today, Rondo is quite diverse, certainly, and by every measure of equity, Rondo has not recovered from the destruction caused. When we think about our plan, it is to connect Minnesota leaders like yourselves, equity organizations, and the Rondo community to ensure a better, brighter, and more equitable future. What we have is a blank slate, and this is not an error in my presentation, but it's an illustration of what we have before us here. There is no land that exists today, yet it is an opportunity. A wise woman, Lurleen Baker Kent, has often said, when you understand how systems, processes, tools, and resources work, you become the expert and can influence their application. She is right. She also said that people don't legislate against others, but they do legislate in their interest. On that, she is also right. This wise woman is my mother. Some of you on the call here on the committee know her well, as she has helped guide and influence your decisions over the years. So, what is this big idea? Minnesota's first African-American cultural enterprise district connected to a community land bridge. The big idea is to build back what was lost for African-Americans. The big idea is to celebrate the diversity that exists in Rondo today. The big idea is to be forward thinking about the future and those benefits to all residents of St. Paul, the region, and the state of Minneapolis, or the state of Minnesota, sorry. Why is this such an important proposition? Because by all measure, we have not been as successful as our own aspirations. It is an opportunity to heal and to right the wrong. The big question is, how can MnDOT, Met Council, Ramsey County, and the City of St. Paul work in partnership to ensure equity in transportation, to improve the quality of lives for all Minnesotans? So what you have represented here are all of the various things that improve the quality of life for people. Just in terms of its basics, the idea is to create 12 to 21 acres of land over the freeway. It's a big undertaking, not because it's a structure, because engineering can occur, but because it goes beyond being simply that structure, and it is quite doable. We all know that MnDOT was created in 1976, and when it was created, there were 16 goals that were established along with it. Goals 2, 3, 5, 8, 10, 15, and 16 all speak to why this project can emerge. To achieve equity in transportation, there must be a true desire and expectation that planners, policymakers who understand the systems, processes, tools, and resources of transportation decision-making also fully comprehend perspectives of individuals who live in the affected neighborhoods, the community leaders who represent them, and the unintended consequences of past projects that have exacerbated inequities. Just briefly talking about Transportation Research Board's draft equity and transportation policy, it defines it this way: equity ensures fair distribution of mobility options. We talk about mobility equity, transportation investment. It further states that historic and current disparities are important considerations. So there's a total capital investment that's required on the construction end, but there's a path that also is required in the pre-development phase. When we think about investment, we also think about return. The equity in transportation can bring about economic opportunities that can be considerable. Housing, 576 units. Jobs, between 1,300 and 1,800 new and permanent jobs. Community growth, upwards of 1,000 new residents. The creation of 140,000 square feet of retail, office, nonprofit, and institutional space. Keeping in mind, Rondo lost 300 businesses. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have descendants who are in business have their offices and their businesses where their family had so much loss? Then finally, untaxed land that has the potential to bring about 3 million to 4 million a year annually to the city. Those are returns based on investment that are important. Let's for a moment look at a wide range of examples. Duluth has its land bridge and park space. We know certainly that Dallas, Texas has Clyde Warren Park. There are 8 existing land bridges around the country. We've identified and had a chance to visit many of them in Seattle, et cetera. But also we understand that financing in a large way, similarly used on other projects, can also benefit this proposition. Let's look at US Bank Stadium just as one example. $348 million of state resources were invested there. $65 million in interest-free loan for XL Energy Center. Target Field, $350 million. And $90 million for infrastructure, $260 were tied to ballpark construction, and there's CH Field. I only illustrate that to share with you when a state has a vision of what's possible, it can bring that possibility about. I want to talk a little bit about where we are. We do have an intentional path, and it has been a long journey to get to this point. We've conducted many studies prior, done many site visits, have been a real important partner with ULI. Our feasibility study that was funded in part by MnDOT and the City of St. Paul gives us an opportunity to recognize what the cost is and what the phasing is that are going to be required. And so where we rest today is in our planning and financing phase. We think we have a foundation of things that are very, very important with respects to supporting the proposition. The other thing that I think is important to recognize is what we would call a 4P model, a financing model that's restorative. It brings a wide range of parties together to create shared understanding and community ownership success. So this 4P model, public, private, philanthropic, and community, meaning people, is something that we're partnering with ULI National to explore. It will allow for a wide range of participation from community leaders, policymakers, practitioners. We anticipate a restorative model to emerge. We do see the state as a partner in this regard. The 2018 ULI report recommends a phased approach to funding. We are in the pre-development phase, and I just want to highlight a couple of the activities that we'll be engaged in with respect to that. Establishing a team for master planning as part of that phase zero. Increasing staff recruitment and CEO champions. Preparing for increased property impacts, understanding that gentrification and displacement are very, very important things for us to keep our minds on and our focus on. And evaluating redevelopment plans and the redevelopment authority. That's all in phase one, or phase zero rather, recognizing that this is going to help us get to the actual construct. Phase two certainly speaks to the development on top, which is another $500 million worth of potential build, which again is a public-private philanthropic opportunity along with people, those in the community. And finally, there is general operations and maintenance of the site itself. A progress plan is in place. Our strategy documents point us in the right direction. Again, in partnership with ULI, there's a 12 to 24 month plan that all includes establishing, again, the team for master planning. It indicates ensuring that we've got the financing vehicle in place and that we're working in partnership in that regard. Increasing neighborhood awareness and community buy-in. Also, it's an ongoing, regular process. Affirm partnerships with stakeholders, and we see the city, MnDOT, Met Council, Ramsey County, and the state of Minnesota all being a part of that, even beyond to DEED, the Department of Health, the Department of Human Services, all of them we view as partners in this proposition. Finally, making sure that we have done the proper analysis with our organizational partners to ensure that we're being the highest of innovative and being able to resource the effort in a way that is beneficial and restorative. Finally, I'd like to just turn it back over to Mr. Anderson to highlight and close, and then I'll field any questions that people might have.
And thank you, Mr. Baker. I think what we'll do after Mr. Anderson is Mayor Carter is here, and I know he has a very tight schedule. So we'll hear from Mayor Carter, and then we'll have a Q&A for everybody on the panel. Mr. Anderson.
We just want to thank you again for this opportunity to present. When Ron, we do this, we will do this work. There was a quote there from, that was the governor's inaugural address. We had an opportunity to talk to Governor Walz when he was campaigning for the governor. And we had a very, very long talk with him. And when we left that conversation, we were just excited that Governor Walz seemed to grasp what we were trying to say about the Land Bridge Project in St. Paul. We will do this work through the lens of One Minnesota, because we know that when Mankato thrives, Moorhead thrives. When Rondo thrives, the range thrives. What we were hoping, and I think he picked up on it, is that this is in Rondo, but it's for Minnesota. What we learn in Rondo, the blueprint that we establish, how we bring the four P's together, how we unite community activism with caring and understanding governmental entities, we can take this blueprint to the range. We can take it to Moorhead. We can take it to Waseca. We can build One Minnesota utilizing the same tools, because we know that those tools are going to work. Rondo can be the laboratory for perfecting them, and then Rondo can be the project that shares it throughout One Minnesota. So that's our presentation, and we thank you for your interest, and we look forward to hearing from our mayor, Mayor Carter from the city of St. Paul. Thank you again.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Anderson, Mr. Baker. And, you know, I just noted so many wonderful things that you imparted to us. But I believe when it was you, Mr. Anderson, said that this is an opportunity to heal and right the wrong, an opportunity to heal and right the wrong. And I thought that was very salient and very important for us. Mayor Carter, it is so good to see you. I appreciate your being with us, and you know, we have the Reconnect Rondo project, but I think, you know, broader issues around transportation and equity, which you have been involved with for many, many, many years, even before you were elected to the city council. And we so appreciate your being here. Welcome to the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee. Please state your name for the record. And following Mayor Carter's comments, we'll have Q&A from the committee. Welcome, Mayor Carter.
Thank you so much, Chair Hornstein, and also members of the committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to participate in this important hearing on the future of I-94. Like Mr. Anderson and so many others who call St. Paul home, the construction of I-94 isn't just a matter of historical record for me, but one of family history. Three generations ago, my great-grandparents fled lynchings and racial violence of the Deep South and resettled to the Rondo neighborhood here, just a short walk from here. They built a life for themselves and their children. They invested their earnings in their community and purchased property and participated in the civic life in one of the most vibrant African-American neighborhoods in the Midwest. When I-94 was constructed, my family was among those who had their lives and their livelihoods uprooted in the name of progress. My grandfather lost over a half a dozen commercial properties that he owned there, and our family inheritance was gutted. As we heard described earlier, an estimated $90 million in community wealth in today's dollars was lost as a result of that highway coming through. And not just of the highway, but of the decision-making processes that we, and I say the royal we, as our city, our county, our state, our federal government worked together to do this in a way that did not reflect and honor the dreams, the desires, the wishes of our community. More immeasurable, though, are lost connections to family, neighbors, and friends that were broken apart as residents and business owners were forced to give up their shops and their homes. Growing up, we'd be traveling along the freeway just around the Dale Street Bridge, and my father would say, "You're in my bedroom now." As we'd pass right under that bridge. When we look at episodes like this in history, it's easy to believe that there must have been some grand conspiracy hatched in a smoke-filled room to undermine that community. But my career in community organizing and public service has taught me that more often than not, decisions like that are a result of how decision makers choose to define the goals and values for these types of projects, and who from the community gets included in the conversation as critical decisions are made. Stated plainly, I've learned that decisions are made to benefit the decision makers. And if we really are going to be serious about equity and dismantling disparities in our state, it's got to center around expanding our circle of decision makers to include those who are most impacted by our decisions. Just as the construction of the I-94 represented a moment of monumental change for our city, this is a pivotal moment too. According to the latest estimates from the Metropolitan Council, over 315,000 people call St. Paul home. This is higher than any time since our city was founded, and our growth is only expected to continue over the next couple of decades. From the redevelopment of the former Ford site, into a new Highland neighborhood, to the planning for redevelopment at the Hillcrest Golf Course on the east side, and a number of sites in between, our city is poised to continue one of the most significant periods of economic expansion in our history. As our departments lead this work alongside our community members, we're drawing on the lessons of the past to chart a path where we are collaborating with community members to define our city's future. Guided by our city's core values of equity, innovation, and resilience, we're setting the table for conversations about our highest aspirations for our city and how we get them there in ways that serve us all. Together, we're striving to meet the moment in ways that will ensure prosperity is shared and that we are sustaining our city for future generations to come. We're building a St. Paul for all of us. Nowhere is this approach more clear and more evident than these early stages of planning for the future of I-94. As MnDOT lays the groundwork for refurbishing and improving this corridor and the community it tore apart, we're offered an incredible opportunity to reimagine the relationship between a freeway and the neighborhoods it passes through. The apology to the community for the construction of I-94 that was offered by former MnDOT Commissioner Charlie Zelli and former Mayor Chris Coleman marked not only an acknowledgement of this incredible harm inflicted by those past decisions of state and local government, but a promise to work with those who were impacted and their descendants to open the way to possibilities. For St. Paul, our partnership with Reconnect Rondo is a central part of this commitment. When the highway was originally constructed, community leaders came together to ask the state and local governments to change their design from an elevated highway that would tower over the homes that remained to the recessed configuration we have today. They also asked that pedestrian bridges be added where some of the streets would no longer connect so that residents could more easily cross to see neighbors or go to work or to church. Today, members of our community have asked us to rethink our approach, and we are answering the call. We've made a public commitment to their proposal by including in our 2040 comprehensive plan a policy that calls for lessening the negative impacts of interstate highways by supporting design interventions such as land bridges and landscaping and liner buildings on new bridges that improve connectivity, hide the road, and reduce pollution. We've contributed resources to the early planning work that has begun to explore the potential scale of a land bridge and what types of development could be built on it. Yet, like the original construction of I-94, achieving the dream of restoring a part of Rondo will require financial partnership and close coordination between the City of St. Paul, the State of Minnesota, and our federal government. We ask you, the members of this committee, to work with us to advance a restorative approach to highway investment that will build a stronger St. Paul and a stronger Minnesota and go a long way to righting the wrongs of those who sat in our seats some 60 years ago. Thank you, Chair Hornstein, and thank you all members of the committee for your time and for your consideration of this important request.
Thank you so much, Mayor Carter, for that really, really powerful testimony, and particularly as it relates to your own family's history. Thank you for sharing that with us. I'm going to take a little time for a couple of questions, and then we did have one guest that had to leave by two. We'll hear from him. We'll hear from Representative Richardson, and then we'll move on our agenda from there. But I would like to spend just a few minutes here now with questions from the committee to all of our testifiers that have testified so far. And I see already a question, I believe, from Representative Cagle. Then we'll move to Representative Mason and Bernardi, and then move on from there to our next testifier. Let's keep our questions short, members, so that we can allow our presenters to answer. So our first question then goes to Representative Cagle.
Chair and Mr. Anderson, Mr. Baker, before you were through with your presentation, I had written down on my notes, Interstate 35, Duluth. I grew up in Duluth and went to college up there. And, you know, the advantage of Zoom here is that we can multitask on the internet too. And so I just did a quick Google search of the Leif Erickson Park and how much economic development that generated for Duluth. And so I'm just really excited about this, and not so much of a question, but just wanted to convey my enthusiasm. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. And just for our testifiers, Representative Cagle is our vice chair and is very involved in a lot of the equity and safety issues that we are dealing with here as a committee. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, I mean, this is an incredibly ambitious project and one that just really strikes home. I grew up in a neighborhood in Cleveland, Ohio, right near Republic Steel. It was the same neighborhood my parents grew up in. Mm-hmm. It's the same neighborhood my, you know, other members of my family lived. And again, in the 50s, when the freeway went through, people dispersed. Occasionally, you'd see them at weddings or funerals. Mm-hmm. But you lost all the connections. So mm-hmm. What you're trying to do is just absolutely incredible. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for your comments, Representative Mason. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Keith Baker and Marvin Anderson for being here today, and thank you for their leadership. I did attend the Rondo Healing Ceremony and Reconciliation event, and it was truly an honor to be at that meeting, and it was very, very moving, and so I felt it a privilege to be there, and thank you very much. And I wanted to connect with you a little bit about just the Hallie Q. Brown Center has such rich history there, and sharing the history and the wonderful community of Rondo neighborhood. And just want to say, when I was down in Atlanta and I visited Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Museum, it brought to life, because I grew up in a time when Rondo, when the highway was there, and it brought back to me what a vibrant middle class African American community looked like, and what we are missing in Minnesota because of this. And I just want to let you know of the important work that we all need to do together to bring that back to life in our community and our state.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. Are there any other questions from committee members? Okay, unless I'm missing something, which happens once in a while. I appreciate all of your testimony, Mr. Baker, Mr. Anderson, Mayor Carter, very illuminating. And I think that the clarity of your request in terms of presenting the timeline and what your needs are currently, I think are really very, very helpful. And I think to frame this issue as one of restorative justice, I think is particularly important as we move forward. And of course, there's many issues around equity that we'll be exploring this week. You know, February 4th is the birthday of Rosa Parks. And I think the Montgomery bus boycott, for example, is a way that transportation and equity coincide. And so we'll be looking a lot at public transportation as we move through the week, and jobs and training as well. So again, to all of you, thank you for your testimony. And we look forward to, you know, continuing our partnership with you, and really looking at ways in which the state can be more active, I think, in this very important work that you're doing. So it very much appreciated you're taking time out of your busy schedules today. Thank you so much. So members, we will continue our hearing. Originally I was going to have Representative Richardson, and we will still have you, Representative Richardson. I just, we have one of our guests has to leave at 2:00. And so I wanted to make sure that he could get his testimony in. Members, what we're going to do now is, and this was referred to earlier in the testimony, there is a real connection between health outcomes and freeways, and of course, transportation infrastructure. And so we will move on from here to a discussion of that, those impacts. I think when we talk about disparities in transportation, you have to include a conversation about health. And so what we're going to do is have Dr. Brian Mutyala, who is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School, speak for several minutes. We'll allow questions and answers for him. And then Representative Richardson will speak as well from her perspective on this issue. I'll introduce her comments separately. And then from there, we'll also continue our conversation about health. So welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Petersburg.
I was just inquiring, just a brief question. Will the Department of Transportation have any comment on this?
We're going to later? Invite them. Yeah, we're going to invite them to a subsequent meeting.
Okay, thank you.
And, they'll be commenting on this and related issues. So
thank you. That's fine. Thank you.
Yes. So we're going to focus on health impacts. And Dr. Mutyala, welcome to the House Transportation Committee, Finance and Policy Committee. Please state your name for the record. Proceed with your testimony. And following your testimony, we'll have questions and answers. And I promise you will be able to get to your 2:00.
Well, Thank you all so much, and thank you for having me. I'm Brian Muthiala. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Minnesota. I'm a clinical skills professor, so I teach first-year medical students also how to take interviews, how to interact with patients, how to use their stethoscopes. And as part of my course, actually, we teach on kind of the structures and history of race and racism, how policies, laws have impacted neighborhoods, communities, and health, so that students who are from Minnesota, students who are not from Minnesota, but who train here can truly appreciate kind of why their communities, their neighborhoods, their patients look the way they do, and why the health of our patients look the way that they do. Personally, this topic is a really important one to me. I went to middle school and elementary school in the Rondo neighborhood. I was a year or two behind Mayor Carter. I went to Central High School. And so this part of St. Paul, this story of the highway of 94 is linked to my growing up. And I think that when I think about this issue of health, I think about issues of equity. I think issues of inclusion. I think of issues of diversity. I think about how, you know, we think about, you know, pollution, morbidity, difficulty accessing care, all of these, the myriad of health outcomes, the myriad of disparities is impacted by kind of the structures, the real bare bones places and ways our patients live. But I come at this this material from also, I think, a really unique perspective in which, you know, my goal is not to teach on disparities that at large, but I really teach clinical skills. I'm teaching individual students how they can really start to build the really beginning skills. How do you introduce yourself? How do you talk to your patients? How do you listen to them, hear them? And to me, this content, this material, this topic is as central as any of those other things, because this idea of understanding how our patients live is central to being a physician. And without a true appreciation of our neighborhoods, the true appreciation of the history of our neighborhoods, it's impossible to get to that. I just gave my a talk 2 weeks ago about some of the laws and policies around redlining, housing discrimination, and the highway policies of 94. And I had emails coming to me from students who grew up in the Twin Cities, who grew up in St. Paul, and they had no appreciation for this history. And so I think that this conversation is really timely and really prescient, because without an understanding of where we've been, it's impossible to move forward in a better way. And I think of all of the, you know, I show my students, I show them pictures of what the Rondo neighborhood looked like. And then I show them pictures of a big highway going through it. And then I show them pictures of what it could have looked like where, what were the alternative routes that the highway could have gone, and why was it chosen to go where it went through? And the students, this is the example that every year students take pause at, because it's something they know, it's something they walk through every minute of every day, and it's something they've never really thought about before. And it speaks to that hidden nature of the things that really impact our patients more than my individual skill levels as a clinician. It's these bigger, broader things that impact my patients. It is the everyday parts of their lives that I'm not able to touch or really understand all the time, but these are the things that really impact health. You know, the health disparities in Minnesota are vast, and I think they stem from a lot of reasons. But I think that when we really understand, and particularly I find when medical students are able to understand the true history of why do our neighborhoods look the way they do, who lives in our neighborhoods, and how have those neighborhoods changed over time? We went through like racial housing covenants this year, and it let students really understand some of the long history that still exists and perpetuates itself today that rears its head in our clinic rooms. And we link that really directly to how this really impacts patients' lives, whether it comes from abilities to afford medications, make follow-up appointments, their exposure to violence, their exposure to pollution, their lived and built environments separate from their communities. You know, that community piece, I think, is something that is indescribable and inarticulatable, but is so, so important and essential. And I think all of these together make me really just grateful for the opportunity to speak to you all today, because this conversation is happening in our my patient rooms. This conversation is happening in our classrooms. And I think seeing that this conversation is happening at the broader policy level gives me a lot of hope, because my students always, they raise their hand, they say, well, what can we do now, right? What can I do as a first year medical student to be able to share with them that these conversations are happening and you can come and you can participate in these just as I've been able to and been asked to do today, I think is a blessing. And I'm just really grateful for the time, and I'll kind of stop there and pause there and happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, doctor. Are there any questions for Dr. Mutyala? Okay, let's see here. Represent Petersburg. Or was that from last time?
Sorry, yeah, that was from last time. I didn't take my hand down. Sorry about that.
Okay, that's okay. Well, thank you, doctor, and thank you for your teaching and connecting these issues with your students. And I think, again, your personal story is very, very impactful, having grown up in that community. So thank you so much. And
thank you very much.
I got you to your next appointment a little early.
Very grateful. Thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for your time.
Thank you. Okay, members, I know that some of you are aware and have been following our select committee on racial justice that we had members from both sides of the aisles participate in. During fall, there were a series of hearings. There's a report, and if you have not looked at that report, I would strongly encourage you to do so. There are some very, very important principles and definitions and research and recommendations for us as a legislature for how we can include racial equity in all of our deliberations and discussions. That's what we're doing today. That's what we'll be doing for a bit on Thursday. And I'm just so pleased that the co-chair of that committee also sits on our committee, Representative Ruth Richardson. And Representative Richardson has been very involved in, again, the intersection of transportation equity for many, many years prior to when she was elected. She's worked quite a bit on the Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program. She has really powerful stories of growing up and her family history. And so I wanted to have Representative Richardson just give us a little context as a colleague for what we have heard so far today. What we will hear from Dr. Sarah Panini will amplify in much more detail some of the specific issues around health outcomes, and Representative Richardson's very interested in that as well. So we'll just take a few minutes here for Representative Richardson to give us a briefing. And again, I think we've seen in other committees some brief explanation of the report, and your perspective, Representative Richardson, I think is very, very important for us. So welcome to the committee. You don't have to state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. And thank you, Mr. Baker and Mr. Anderson, for presenting today. I was born and raised in Frogtown. My family's story is pretty similar to what Mayor Carter talked about. My family fled the Deep South. The terror, the lynchings that were occurring is why they made a decision to settle in St. Paul before I was born. And growing up in Frogtown, the trauma and the destruction of the Rondo community was heavy. It was still very raw, and heard many stories about the displacement and the loss related to that. And Mr. Anderson, I think that you just did a really great job in terms of describing how Rondo was really the heartbeat of the Black community in St. Paul for many decades. It was a spiritual center, faith community, business hub, a social center, a center for civil rights. And it's not lost on me, and I'm sure it's not lost on members of the committee, that it was a community that was thriving in the face of overt discrimination and systemic racism as well, because it was thriving in the midst of a time period of where there were brutal redlining practices, mortgages were being denied for home improvements, or denying Black buyers mortgages in white communities. Discriminatory housing covenants were in effect, And they created an atmosphere where there would be isolation and segregation as well. And so in the midst of all of those challenges, there was still this bright, thriving community. And it's important, I think, that we continue to understand that the when we talk about systemic racism and the challenges that we see with the destruction of Rondo and also what's happening today, these were all policy decisions. These were not decisions that were accidents. These were by design. They were intentional, and they were also government sanctioned as well. And so when we acknowledge that the decision to destroy this Black thriving community by running an interstate through it, it's important that we lift up and amplify the fact that that was not an accident to destroy the heartbeat of the Black community within St. Paul. And I think it's important that we also amplify and lift up is the reality that 94, it stands as a monument to the impacts of systemic racism. That's what it is. And those effects are continuing to be felt today, because not only are we talking about the families who lost their homes, their livelihood, their ability to pass wealth from one generation to the next, but also there have been substantive impacts to the health and the life expectancy of individuals who grow up and live along that corridor as well. And when we take into account that what happened in the Rondo community, it's not unique to Minnesota. It's not unique to St. Paul. There were communities across the United States where BIPOC communities had their neighborhoods plowed through to make way for freeways. And it not only left sort of significant trauma and loss, but it left those communities with higher risks for cancer, heart disease, and childhood asthma rates increased along those corridors as well. Myself and my seven brothers and sisters, we all went to Maxfield Elementary School. Most of us had asthma, growing up along that corridor. And so understanding the impacts of pollution and the environmental factors of the decision to run the freeway is something that continues to have impact down to this very day. And now layer on top of that the COVID pandemic that we are currently within, for communities that like the Rondo neighborhood that have already these underlying conditions, they're also experiencing some of the highest risk factors associated with COVID. And what the research is telling us is that the more air pollution, individuals with asthma, they're also having a higher rate of deaths as it relates to the COVID-19 pandemic as well. And so understanding how these decisions also impact health, I think, is really critical and important for our committee to be thinking about as well. And again, these outcomes, these health disparities, they're not accidents. They're part of policy decisions that have been made. And so just in closing, I what we really discussed within the House Select Committee on Racial Justice and with the report that has now been published, when we look at the deep disparities that are persistent and unacceptable across all of our different systems, including thinking about our transportation system as well, we didn't get to these issues with colorblind, non-discriminatory policies. And it is going to take color-conscious policies to address the disparities and to really have a reconciliation. And while we know that we cannot change the past, we as legislators do have an opportunity to focus on building a transportation system that is going to promote health, equity, and access for all. And so I really appreciate, again, Mr. Anderson and Mr. Baker, you coming here with a project that is truly a project of hope and a project of reconciliation. And to be able to know that we are moving to a space of addressing not only the historic wrongs, but the legacy of those that are continued to be carried and felt by residents today.
Representative Murphy, thank you so much, Representative Richardson. And, you know, you couldn't have teed up and introduced our next speaker in a better way, and I'll introduce her more formally first. But I saw your hand up, Representative Murphy, and I wanted to make sure that I called on you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you so much. This is my first time I've spoken in the Committee of Transportation. But we went on our bonding trip. We went down University through Frogtown, and now in the map that Mr. Baker presented of the bridge, the Rondo Land Bridge project, Frogtown was part, I believe Frogtown was part of that map. And now Ms. Richardson has talked about growing up in Frogtown. I wonder if we could clarify more what part of the Rondo Land Bridge and the Rondo Renaissance, what that will do to the Frogtown neighborhood as well as the previous Rondo neighborhood.
So
bring that in together. And if it's a policy, if these were policy decisions that were made and we want to do something for future policy making by investing in this hope and dream and renaissance, what will happen to all of St. Paul?
Okay, well, that's an excellent question. So I think what we'll do here, Representative Murphy, is I'll have either Mr. Baker or Mr. Anderson respond to your question. And if Representative Richardson wants to say, respond as well as someone who grew up in Frogtown, that would be appropriate. And then we'll pivot then quickly after that to Dr. Sarah Panini's presentation. So either Mr. Baker or Mr. Anderson and or Representative Richardson, if you'd like to respond to Representative Murphy's question about, I guess, geography and impacts on Frogtown and in the broader city of St. Paul.
Right. Well, I'll begin by saying we understand the historical context and the historical boundaries of Rondo, which is Rice Street to Lexington, historically. So all communities that reside currently within that boundary are tied to the Rondo history. The land bridge itself, we can visualize it as almost like a community healing power source, if you will, that really is beneficial to the historic Rondo boundary, while it may have a geographic focus in terms of location.
Representative Hornstein,
Mr. Anderson.
Yeah, Representative Hornstein and Representative Murphy. Rondo went, as Keith Baker has indicated, Rice to Lexington, and then the outer boundaries were University and Selby. That was the Rondo neighborhood as we traditionally knew it. Frogtown started on the north side of University, where Rondo ended on the south side. But as Martin Luther King has said, a rising tide raises all boats. So we feel that if the land bridge is a reality, when it becomes reality, those communities that are next to Rondo will also benefit from it as well. So it's not, we're going to forget Frogtown or Summit University to that regard. It will raise everybody's profile, but the land bridge itself is on Rondo Avenue, the corridor between Lexington and Rice.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson, and thank you, Representative Murphy. Okay, Members and Representative Richardson, thank you so much for that context. And I think you really did a tremendous job of just setting up our last speaker for the afternoon. Dr. Lalitha Sarapanini, who is also a professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota. And she will actually get into some of the issues you raised, Representative Richardson, in a lot more depth. Some of the medical and health questions that you raised, Representative Richardson, not, as they impact Rondo, but really as they impact residents, whether they live along freeways or other sources of air pollution, you know, in terms of health disparities and health outcomes. And so Dr. Sarapanini is, I've heard her speak many times on related topics and does an excellent job of kind of connecting some of our policy decisions to health. And I'm so glad, Dr. Sarapanini, you could be with us today. Welcome to the House Transportation Committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Lalitha Sarapanini. Thank you, Chair Hornstein and committee members, for this opportunity. I am also an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School, along with Dr. Mutyala. So we care for, you know, hospitalized patients. I didn't grow up in Minneapolis, but I do take care of patients who live near I-94 and who are hospitalized with asthma. And I also teach medical students about the what we call social determinants of health. And, you know, I feel like everyone today has really put out all of the points that I wanted to mention in my testimony as well. And thank you, Representative Richardson, for mentioning some of those health effects. As hospital doctors, we often find it very frustrating to take care of patients in that one, you know, clinical encounter and send people back into that same environment, same polluted environment that put them in the hospital in the first place. So I'm really excited today to be part of, a hearing around a community-based solution. I'll be very honest, I had a 5-minute, very well-timed, you know, testimony full of data and points, but I want to put that aside and kind of really speak from my heart about some of the things that I've heard today in the testimony. I truly believe in bilateral learning, so I don't want to just, you know, speak from like the ivory tower of science. But I did want to start off by discussing some of the health impacts of living in close proximity to, you know, busy roads and highways. So the lived experience that many have described today really is borne out in the data. So estimates slightly vary based on study, but proximity to highways is a major risk factor for health. So up to 1 to 2 city blocks and even more, people who live in those areas are impacted most. Even within that area, different segments of the population are impacted disproportionately by air pollution. So for example, children naturally breathe more number of times and they spend more time outdoors. And so they're exposed to more pollution. Specifically, ozone has been shown to stunt the growth of lungs, and kids who live around, busy roadways are also hospitalized more often with asthma attacks. And so now if we think about this in this like historical context of a cumulative exposure of air pollution over a lifetime, you know, going to school there, living there, we really begin to see those health impacts. And Representative Richardson mentioned, we're also seeing that the impacts from COVID-19 are more severe when someone has lived in communities, you know, with higher air pollution. And I'm barely scratching the surface here because, you know, air pollution impacts every single organ in our body. And it's not just physical health, but as we heard, today from Mr. Anderson, we're just beginning to study and understand the impacts of cumulative mental health trauma and generational trauma of projects like these. And I was also very struck by transportation equity that Mr. Baker mentioned, because there's a huge overlap between transportation and access to healthcare. And I see this in my practice as well. You know, we know that highways in a community doesn't necessarily mean that everyone has access to transportation. One of the biggest reasons that people miss medical care, whether that's, you know, doctor's appointments or picking up medications, it is lack of access to transportation. And just yesterday, I took care of a patient who had to be admitted to the hospital because they haven't sought medical care in 6 months. And so projects like Reconnect Rondo with land use change and to focus on people and not cars can improve access to healthcare. And I was also very looking at the strategic investments in, you know, active transportation infrastructure and green spaces will improve people's physical and mental health. And I think from an equity and justice standpoint, as Mr. Anderson and Mr. Baker were mentioning, community-based solutions and not something that just comes from an outside can really, you know, help reduce air pollution, carbon emissions, and also help improve the health of our communities. So I'm so honored to have been involved in this testimony and, you know, very excited for, you know, an opportunity to build a future that's based on our values and a future that truly centers communities, public health, and justice. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sarah Panini. Are there, let's check and see if there's some questions from the committee. Representative Petersburg and Representative Olson, I see your hands up. Let's start with Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have some questions that kind of get that raised as I was hearing testimony from the beginning to the end. And that is, you know, I looked at, you know, the I-94 corridor is certainly longer than just the Rondo area. And it certainly bisects communities all along that direction. And so earlier we heard that the decision to build 994 was by policy decision to break up Rondo. And my question is, didn't it also make the same decision to break up other communities? And why is the other communities not having the same issues that Rondo has? And then a follow-up question, and that is in regards to listening to people, to the doctors talk about the health impacts of living next to the freeway. Well, isn't that true of 35E and 35W, et cetera? We know that I-35E, for example, had a lot of contracts discussed about with the neighbors, et cetera, on how to come up with those decisions on where and how to build it. The question just becomes, you know, how is Rondo community different than the other communities that are separated? And why are we going to be then talking about having to do something like this in all the other communities as well? It's just a kind of a question that seems to be one that certainly can be asked. I'm certainly trying to learn, so I'm not indicating knowledge of everything. I'm just curious. Thank you.
I appreciate that, Representative Petersburg. I'm so glad, Mr. Anderson, Mr. Baker, that you stuck around for the whole hearing, because actually, you know what, we have about 12 more minutes, and so members, I think you can direct your questions to Mr. Anderson, Mr. Baker, or Dr. Sarah Panini. But I think that, how about Mr. Anderson, and you can take the question about you know, land bridges and other communities and how freeway construction impacted other communities as well. And then Dr. Sarah Panini, you can talk maybe more holistically also in response to Representative Petersburg's question. Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein and Representative Petersburg. The other communities had options. They had housing options. They could move. Redlining was a factor in affecting the Rondo community. There were no options. It was the law that you couldn't, they wouldn't show apartment buildings. You couldn't sell a house to an African American when the freeway came through. Prospect Park had options. They could move. They could move their family to another part of town, and they could reestablish their life. Not easily. It's never easy to move your home and your family, but you have to think of Rondo as an enclave in a sense. That was all they had. And that's what was presented to them. there is really no other option for us to go. Many people from Rondo ultimately left town because there were just the options in 1950, 55 and 60 when it started for an African-American to gather his family and move to Highland. They would not show you a home. To move to Grand Avenue, they wouldn't show you a business. The rents were high. The options were so limited to the people of Rondo that they felt abandoned. They lacked the means and they lacked the financial resources to reclaim a life that they had spent years establishing in Rondo. And then the urban renewal said it was a slum. The other communities weren't designated slums. They didn't carry that designation that you are a part of the city that we needed to get rid of. The northern route was proposed as an alternative where no community would have been affected by I-94. But the mayor of St. Paul, in a famous cartoon in the city of St. Paul that I'd be happy to share with you, was asked, which would you prefer, slums or redevelopment? And the slum aspect was referring to Rondo. So you carry this stigma that I was born in a slum. I had very few options. I had no job that I could, no housing where I could take my family. And I'm left with this. And to compare that to the other communities of Prospect Park and those communities just wasn't a fair balance for them. They lost it. And that's where the mental things came in. Now, other communities have had the opportunity to express how they felt about Rondo, about the freeway. One famous person called the governor of Governor Anderson, and Governor Anderson interceded and had the freeway moved so it wouldn't take a monument in Prospect Park. We couldn't call the governor of that. We could not call the governor and say, this freeway is going to affect me in such a way, and it was actually physically moved. So there are differences between Rondo, Prospect Park, and the other communities. And those differences were the same way that the other 1,600 communities across the country were felt. They were at a disadvantage financially, politically, and we were taken advantage of because of those, we did not possess those assets that other communities had.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. I think Representative Petersburg, you did have a question for Dr. Serapanini, and then we do need to move on because I have three more questions and then we only have about 8 minutes left. So Dr. Serapanini.
Yeah,
the question was about the more global aspects of health impacts along highways.
Yeah, and also in regards to this particular land bridge, when we consolidate as a tunnel, all the exhaust that's going to come out from that as being more concentrated, won't that exacerbate the problem as well? Thank you.
Dr. Serapanini.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. I think, you know, air pollution from whatever source it comes will impact health. So speaking generally, whether that's whatever highway name that you want to give, you're right that air pollution is bad for our health. But then by the time you come to impact, there's also other factors to consider with individual, health and population health as well. And that's where we start to see the disparities in health outcomes and who actually suffers the impact of health. And I think, in interest of time, I would like to stop there. Thank you.
Okay. Well, and as is our policy, our committee policy is that any member, we'll pass on any additional questions and short answers if you want to give them if folks don't have time. But I'm confident we have time because we have Representative Olson, then Nelson, and Representative Kagan will have the last question. Representative Olson.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this question is going to be directed towards Dr. Serapanini again. I'm just wondering, because I guess I don't understand. I'm just a social studies teacher, so I'm truly trying to figure out the answer to this. How Is there science behind how living on top of a road would be better for your health than living alongside a road?
Thank you, Chair. That is a good question. And I guess I'm trying to understand the question. I think the data that we have is based on proximity. And I don't know that there is any data that talks about like vertical versus, you know, horizontal distance from the source of pollution. But having, you know, access to roads that are have more green infrastructure, where you reduce the number of vehicle miles traveled, so you reduce your exhaust, and having cleaner cars, all of those contribute to, you know, decreasing the source of that health impact, which is air pollution. And of course, we have to do everything else along with that, including improving access to healthcare and improving the general health of the population.
Do you have any follow-up, Representative Olson?
Oh, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Dr. Serapinini. I really appreciate that.
Thank you for your question. Representative Nelson.
Turn my camera on here. Chair Hornstein and members, you know, they're talking about this. I grew up along I-94 in Brooklyn Center. My parents' home, the bedroom window I slept in was right out the entrance ramp of what eastbound 694 off of Brooklyn Boulevard. So, and my family was affected by, in many ways, by the building of I-94. If you start at the north end of the Lowry Here Tunnel, all the way up through Brooklyn Center, and because of that, it was different land back then. In Brooklyn Center, where the land was built, it was farmland that they went through. It got set aside for that. There were a few homes that were taken out, but not that many. I do have a brother-in-law whose parents' home would be right where the Lowry Bridge is over the 94. I'm not sure if he's on the northbound or the southbound lane it would be, but his home was taken there. I have an uncle who worked for a plant that was on the right at Highway 55 and 94 would be, and it originally was going to be taken and then was spared. So it's a different situation through there. And the Camden area, when they went through there, a relative of my family that came here were immigrants and built a business up, their business was taken by because of the freeway going through the Camden area. So there are other differences, but I think Mr. Anderson had the best example. My relatives were white, and they were paid for their homes. They weren't called slums. They weren't underpaid, and they were able to move where they wanted to move, and not struck by some of the racial and redlining that went on back then. So there are differences in how they were acting. I guess this is more of an answer to what Representative Torkelson was asking. There are differences in the way that people were treated in North Minneapolis and through Brooklyn Center when they built 94.
Thank you. Thank you for that perspective, Representative Nelson. So our last question, I believe, is from Representative Cagle, Vice Chair Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had actually just texted you. My question was answered. I just wanted kind of to also make the point that what Representative Nelson said, you know, I grew up in Maple Grove, and when they ran 610 through, it was through land that the community had planned to be a highway. And so I think, you know, what Representative Nelson was saying is that it's definitely different land and people had options. That was just the point I wanted to make as well.
Okay. Well, thank you, Representative Cagle, for that. And I don't see any additional questions. So again, I wanted to thank all of our presenters. I want to thank you, Representative Richardson, for offering your perspective. I want to encourage everybody to read the report that Representative Richardson is the co-chair of the Select Committee on Racial Justice. And members, we're going to hear more about transit and equity and job training on Thursday. And we'll also hear a bill on Thursday that also, I think, in a way, is a related to the intersection of transportation and equity. And that's the bill from Representative Jamie Becker Finn on driver's license revocation. So, and that bill, we'll hear the second part of our hearing on Thursday. And so with that, members, I want to thank again, Mr. Baker, Mr. Anderson, and Dr. Serapanini. We do really appreciate your time. This was a very engaging and important hearing, and we appreciate you and your work. And with that, members, this meeting is adjourned.